Young. This is April 16th, 2007. Tape's on okay? All right. Tonight we're going to have some testimony. Our committee staffer is going to read us through what will soon be out as the Dash 3s and give you a rough look at it. We are kind of on a fast track, as many of you may realize already. We have outstanding bets on whether we end up with Dash 3s, 4s, 5s, 6s, 7s, or 8s.
Not until all the amendments to my bills get done from my committee.
And I've been informed by the good Senator Monza Anderson that we better get moving here so that she can get her bills through ahead of us. And we are more than willing to work with you on that. Having said that, my goal tonight is to get us out of here as close to 6:30 as possible, even though we're getting started late. It's been a long day for many of us, and I want to get good testimony in. I want to hear what people have to say, but I also want to get you home in a reasonable hour. I expect we'll be back here Wednesday going at it with the Dash 3s in a more readable form for us. So having said that, Rick, would you take us through this?
Thank you, Chair. At the dais is a one-page bulleted, just a real brief summary Legislative Council did of the forthcoming Dash 3 amendments. Let me just kind of specify, these are very summary and rough. Nothing's official until we see the actual LC amendments, and so some of the wording may vary a little bit from what the members have in front of them there. So just quickly, and these references will be made in terms of the changes made to the Dash 2s. So looking at that and starting at the top, there was minor changes to the preamble. There were some references to long-term care, or Medicare that AARP pointed out that was removed from the preamble. In Section 5 of the Dash 2 amendments, we did modify how the board is set up. It removes compensation for the directors and limits the board membership to less than a majority with incomes tied, or that boards cannot be have a majority of income tied to health care or health insurance industries.
And I always appreciate how they always say that backwards. The majority of the board has to be people who are not getting a compensation from the health care industry. And that's what we'll read when you see the Dash 3s. Okay? Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. And then in Section 6 of the Dash 2s, again, and more changes made to the board structure. The board members' terms will expire in January 1 of 2010, but they may serve until successors are appointed. This, again, is an attempt to make the board more transitionary, kind of a transitory board versus a permanent governance board right off. Section 7, then, of the forthcoming amendments will give the executive director authority to hire staff. That was missing from the Dash 2s, so there's been some cleanup along the way as well. Section 10.
Let me make a comment on this so you understand what comes out, and I believe this is the right place to talk about this. The executive director needs to come on board immediately after end of session. By the time you get a board through confirmation, you'll be looking at September, October for Lucky. Then you've got Christmas, and the board doesn't restart its work until probably January. And that's just reality of how the system works. We want the director to be on board, working, setting up committees, getting things ready for that board, so when the board is available, they're ready to go to work. They're not going to have to spend a lot of time getting set up and ready to go. Sorry to interrupt, Rick. Go ahead.
Fine, Chair. And then this in Section 10, we do include wording that would exclude the Oregon Health Fund from monies dedicated to long-term care, support, services, and administration. These were recommendations made by several groups to ensure that we don't attach Medicaid and other long-term support dollars into the fund. A majority of your changes were made in Section 11, and this is starts on page 9 of the Dash 2 amendments that are in regard to the subcommittees. You did some cleanup language in there, for example, referring on page 10, line 17, removing other federal matching funds from that language. You did include language then in Section 11 that ensures that existing prepaid managed care programs are basically set up in such a way that ensures the viability of this whole network of services. And while we don't have the exact language, there'll be some incorporated language into that to ensure that we kind of maintain that viability. Also in Section 11, it does include language to eliminate duplicate agencies. For example, on page 11 of the dash twos, there was a whole list of agencies and entities, and the decision was made to include language that allows this board to at some point look at duplication of efforts and to make some decisions about whether or not some of these agencies need to be melded together, eliminated, that type of thing. So it gives the board a little bit more authority in that area. Some changes came from the Health Services Commission in terms of modifying language about how to give it basically the Health Services Commission a little bit more responsibility for recommending changes to the methodology. These came from the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. So again, it kind of gives HSC, Health Services Commission, a little bit more authority to work with that methodology that they've refined. In Section E, there was quite a bit of in Section 11, we went back and pulled a lot of language. If you remember from our 31207 version of the Senate Bill 329, and I have extra copies if you'd like to see it, the decision was made to extract some language from this 312 version, specifically Section 13, that had a lot of language about the accountable health plans, and reincorporate that into this the dash 3 amendments. So if you go back to the 312.07 version of 329, where there was, again, Section 13 talked about accountable health plans and setting standards for the health plans. This language now will appear in the new dash 3s when it comes out. The chair has decided that was important stuff to have in there. Also, there will be a separate section broken out to talk about the board's authority to develop not only an exchange but also to look at such things as health savings accounts and other types of novel methods to allow people to purchase health care. And that will be a new section in 11. We've done just some cleanup language. We included eligibility enrollment. There's going to be sections to include grievance and appeals processes in the whole model that consumers will have an ability, again, to appeal. There were some changes moving just some sections around. We thought some things worked better in other parts of the Section 11. And, again, the majority of subcommittee members that are developed in the Dash 2 amendments should have, again, less attachment to the healthcare industry. There'll be an effort to get people who aren't too invested in healthcare on those different subcommittees. Then in Section 13 of the, again, dash 2s, it will allow the board to implement changes immediately once the comprehensive plan is approved by the legislature, and if no changes are required per federal or state law. In Section 14 of the dash 2s, we did add additional language at the recommendation of Oregon Health Policy Research to kind of beef up the evaluation section on that. In Section 17, we did remove or at least modify the certificate of need language and added that they will basically bring on the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. In Section 19, again, this is, again, additional language that says that nothing in this act will infringe upon contracts that are entered in between managed care organizations and the state. So once the board is enacted, we won't interfere with existing contracts that might exist between fully captured health plans and the state. And then last, we did add some language to, and this comes back from our old version of 329, the 312.07 version, that basically adds an advanced directive registry, and that we did add the Section 9, which was the individual mandate from the old version of the 312 version. So if you have this, Section 9 is now added back into the Dash 3 amendments. And that, Mr. Chair, is a brief overview.
That's a pretty good brief overview of about 6 hours of work, and then more by LC. We'll get more of this out to you when it actually comes. I think it's going to be out late today or first thing tomorrow morning. You'll have a better chance of seeing it then. And I know in this context it's hard to follow. The goal here was,
we have it.
As I speak, it's being added to us. Okay. The goal here is to have more of a design team and an interim board to start this process and then come back at the 09 legislature with that roadmap laid out. We don't want to tie the hands of this board too tightly, yet we want to give them good direction, and that's what we're trying to do, and that's a sort of a careful play to make. You can't push it too far one way or the other. So at your leisure, please read through these. Are these the dash fours?
Yeah, I'm just here. Inadvertently called them a dash threes. We had a dash three at the last meeting, which were the Samaritan Ministries amendments. So these are actually the only new major gun stuff.
I'm glad to see these are dash fours. That gets me closer to winning my bet. Thank you. And I can always manipulate things to get to where I need to be. These are bets that are going on that nobody knows the numbers except those of us who put ourselves in the pool. So I would ask you to look at these at your leisure. We want to take testimony tonight now. So we'll start with Mr. Craig Hostetler.
They're over there fighting.
I'd like to point out in the dash fours, too, that I have not read these, so if there's any major errors in these, it is the error of Senator Westland, my co-chair. Craig, would you step up and identify yourself? And these microphones have to get pretty close to you for us to pick up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chairs Bates and Westland, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Craig Hostetler from the Oregon Primary Care Association. And I've got a copy of my testimony going around, and I've submitted a letter, or my organization submitted a letter on April 11th. So I'm going to touch on the key points, because you've heard this, some of this stuff over and over for those of you that I've been talking with, and I want to make sure you can get out quickly, as you discussed at the beginning of this session. So basically, overall, my organization and the community health centers that we represent are very supportive of this bill, so I wanted to state that first and foremost. But there are just a few amendments, and I couldn't catch whether they came up in 329-4 or not, so if they are, then forgive me. I just looked at 329-2 when we created these amendments. Basically, the four key issues that we're outlining within our letter and the key components of the letter are attached as an amendment for you. Are one, that we agree and thank the committee for its recognition of the importance of realigning financial incentives to support the primary and preventive care, especially with regards to the primary care home model. And so we're in complete support of that, and you've heard testimony before from me on the primary care home model, so I won't go into exactly what that is, but it's within the written testament. The second piece that we're taking a look at is that we urge the committee to clarify the need for reform to maximize federal and other public sources without compromising support for proven programs that are working, particularly for those that are serving vulnerable populations. And the intent here is that as we go towards a new system, which we all want to go towards, that we don't leave the programs that were set up by federal design that really do a good job, an effective and efficient job of serving vulnerable populations. So to keep that intact, as we go towards this new system of hopefully getting everybody coverage, of course we can put things on the table, but let's start going in that direction first. The third point that we outlined is that we thank the committee for acknowledging the role and importance of core safety net healthcare providers within the context of comprehensive healthcare reform. But given the current bill language defining the safety net providers as specific references to federally qualified health centers or otherwise called community health centers, as well as tribal organizations and school-based health centers, we offered some clarity to use the definition of core safety net providers. That's a little bit broader. And that is to serve, the core safety net providers serve a substantial share of people experiencing barriers to accessing care, such as homelessness, the need for culturally competent care, mental illness, substance abuse, cognitive impairment, reduced functional abilities, social and geographic isolation, and the lack of health insurance. Also, in regards to the proposed toll-free primary care referral line, we appreciate the committee's recognition of our continued role to serve uninsured and other vulnerable populations. But given our role to serve both the insured and uninsured populations, we request that the committee amend the bill to encourage the use of this line by all persons who experience barriers to health care, so not just on insurance, but the other barriers that I listed before. And our final point is that we're happy to see representation of consumer advocates on the Health Trust Board, and just offer a small clarification there to ensure that consumer advocates include representatives of low-income and vulnerable populations. So again, we're eager to participate in the system redesign process outlined in Senate Bill 329-2 and whatever version you all end up with. And thank you again for the opportunity to testify on this important legislation.
Well, committee members, any questions? Craig, on page 4 here, you have proposed language for several sections of the dash 2s. Are these your major proposals cover your major concerns?
They do, yes.
Thank you. We will take that into careful consideration.
Okay.
I think some of them are already covered in the dash 4s, but I'll have to really read through to make sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Chris Apkar.
Chairs Wes Lennon Bates and members of the committee, my name is Chris Apkar. I am the chair of the Healthcare Committee for the Oregon Small Businesses for Responsible Leadership, and we had the pleasure of meeting with Senator Westland previous to this to review the bill and to express our concerns, and we're very thankful for that. Unfortunately, given the dash threes and fours at the same time, I can't really speak to those. But I will be speaking to the Dash 2 amendments. OSBRL represents small businesses throughout the state of Oregon, and we did endorse Senate Bill 329 as introduced. There are some concerns that OSBRL and I have as a small business and also as a patient over some of the changes that were made that may be addressed in the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s. I think that the bill as a whole is a giant step forward and is much needed for Oregonians, and it's also needed to, besides address the needs of Oregonians in the way of health care, it also creates a more efficiently operating health care delivery system, as well as providing health care coverage for those who currently do not have health care coverage, and the cost which is borne by government, individuals that can't afford it, as well as some of the foundations, the not-for-profits, the safety net clinics that are currently covering that kind of patient care. One of the things that we were supportive of and continue to be supportive of is that, see if this mic works better, is that the idea was to spread the cost. Because one of the concerns of small business is all small businesses that employ people, if you ask them, they would greatly desire to provide health care to their employees, provide health insurance. But sometimes it's gotten down to the point of either the doors stay open or I pay for health insurance, because the costs have increased exponentially and they don't seem to be dropping. In essence, we're getting less coverage for our dollar, and it's costing more money, to the point where many small businesses are not able to afford health care. Some of the concerns that were raised originally and are also that I would like to raise now is there is, at this point in time, no real definite addressing of funding. In order to have small businesses able to participate and afford to participate in this, I think the cost to participate or the funding that will be coming from small businesses needs to be taken into account so that small businesses can actually, again, afford to provide that coverage for their employees. If the cost is too high, then it gets in the way of actually, I mean, Oregon has a whole lot of small businesses, including, if you look at the healthcare industry, many of your providers. they are also small businesses, and in order to keep their doors open, they need to be profitable. I, as the owner of a small business, am in that position. I need to remain profitable to do things like pay the mortgage, and if I can't do that, then it makes things a little bit difficult. Specifically looking at the dash twos, there were some significant changes from the original bill to the dash two amendments, which causes me as the chair of the healthcare committee to have reservations about the bill itself, because some of the changes I think are don't meet the needs of either the small businesses or Oregonians in general. Two of the things that are not addressed in the bill is funding, how it is to be funded, getting down to, say, percentages and so forth. What's the impact going to be? It does not address inflation. There's been runaway inflation in the area of health insurance for some time, double-digit inflation. There's nothing in the bill to address that. One of the things in the dash twos is it did not include, and I understand that it's corrected in the dash threes, that there was included no representation whatsoever from healthcare. I understand the need to limit that, but there was no representation at all in the dash twos. Federal funding, in looking at waivers, that's a wonderful thing, but I think that one of the things that I would recommend that the committee explore is what happens if federal waivers are applied for and they are denied. Because generally CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, likes to look at pilot projects rather than going full bore out into a statewide project. Another is in the dash twos, and I'm not sure if they're addressed in the dash threes or fours, is pre-existing condition clause. From a personal perspective, I've got concerns about that because I do have pre-existing conditions. Another is that the dash twos place the burden of covering the cost of pre-existing conditions for the first year on the employer, which can be rather expensive. And the other is, on the face of it, that particular language is in violation of the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which prevents or prohibits the exclusion of pre-existing conditions if a person is moving from one group health plan to another or continues along the same lines in the same health plan. The other thing is that there are no assurances in the bill that a considerable amount of work went into the planning that resulted in the introduction of Senate Bill 329 in the first place, and there are no assurances in the bill that that discussion that was pretty widespread, pretty collaborative, contained a lot of very good information, is going to be included in the discussions once all is said and done, the legislature goes home and hands this off to the board. Now, page two, I just very specifically addressed given amendments, and I think some of them have been addressed just glancing through the dash fours. One of the things that I would like to make sure of is that some of the conditions that were listed as being totally excluded from the basic health plan are not excluded. Things like burn, you know, somebody gets a third-degree burn on their arm, according to the dash twos, they would not be covered at all. You have a child who's an athlete, has an organ injured in their athletic competition, organ transplants would not be covered. You have a healthy young individual who, if their parents can't afford it, it in essence amounts to a death sentence for that individual. Another, and this is putting on my hat as what I do for a living, which is security and privacy in the healthcare world, is there is a recommendation to move forward with a move towards electronic health information exchange, which I laud, and there's also reference of the use of personal health records by individuals. I also applaud that. But the thing that I do find missing and rather disturbing is that many of the vendors who provide personal health records are not covered by the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act privacy and security provisions. They are not covered by Oregon law. So in essence, the health information, the confidential health information that is held by those vendors on behalf of consumers or patients is not protected by any law or any rule in the state of Oregon, is not protected by federal law. So I think that is something that I would recommend being addressed in the bill at some point, or even in another bill, that there do need to be some protections for the consumer, that their information is going to be kept private if that is the intent to encourage greater use of the information by the individual to manage their care and in reducing the cost. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. Questions? Chris, do you have that in writing?
Yes, I do. What I just spoke of?
Yeah, the last 10 minutes. If you give that to us in writing, I'd appreciate it. I think you'll find a good deal of what you're concerned about are addressed in the dash fours again.
Great.
The dash fours are much closer to the original bill. But there are a couple of issues you brought up that I'm not sure are, and I have to go back and reread the dash fours again for that. So if you can give it to us in writing, give me a good reference point to go back and forth.
I would be more than happy to do that, Chair Bates.
Thank you very much.
As far as the security issues and glancing through the dash fours, I did not see any language that did address the privacy and security of individuals' health care.
Thank you.
Chair.
Ladies first.
Thank you. I want to thank you for coming. It's critical that the small businesses are on board, and the fact that you took the time to really look at this and study it will just give all that more credence to the value of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My question has to do with the security issue. Now, the Veterans Administration and other entities do keep electronic records and will transfer them if you are in a veterans hospital somewhere else. What kind of a security system do they have? Are you...
Chair Bates and Westland and Senator Morissette, currently the Veterans Administration, as well as the State of Oregon Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, as well as your private health care insurers and so forth, they are all covered under the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act privacy and security rules, and which establish specific requirements around privacy and security. And the security rule itself specifically addresses electronic health information exchange, so that there are a list of security requirements that they have to live up to. And fortunately, now the Office of Inspector General is actually starting to conduct security audits to make sure that they are living up to what is considered sound security practice. The problem with the HIPAA legislation was it covered a very small group of individuals, a small portion of the healthcare industry. It covered providers that transmitted electronically. If you just do everything on paper, you're not covered by HIPAA. It covered all health plans, and it did define health plans as including the Veterans Administration, CHAMPIS, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth, and it covers all healthcare clearinghouses. It does not cover third-party vendors, such as vendors that are currently selling personal health records, such as Dossier and Google.
So you're going to provide language that we need to...
I would be more than happy to.
I think that's something, thank you, Senator Morissette. That's probably something we'll probably leave to great degree to the design team or the interim board, but having that language could be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, I will do that. I'm also part of the Oregon Health Information Security and Privacy Collaborative team, and these are some of the things that we are currently working on right now, so I would be very happy to provide that information. I have general privacy and security standards that should be adhered to by any organization.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chris. Your last name still intrigues me, you know. APGAR scores.
That's my great aunt.
Really?
Yes.
Huh. APGAR scores are the basic scores we use for when a child is born to determine how healthy that child is. So it's sort of a vernacular for a physician. You hear APGAR, you think it's your great aunt. Congratulations. Mike Huntington.
Co-chairs Westland and Bates and members of the committee, thank you for allowing
me to speak again, and most of what I say today will be new from last week. My main reason for being here is to impress upon you that there is a broad base of support for a full hearing of Senate Bill 27. Having said that, if anything short of that, we would want more of the key elements of Senate Bill 27 included in Senate Bill 329. I think we should not assume that the 500,000 members of AARP or other retirees in the state agree with AARP's position on these bills, and in particular on considering Medicare as part of the legislation. We have discussed previously why we feel Medicare should be included in consideration. It is a big player. There's no prioritization of very expensive procedures with relation to the health that they cause or bring to our citizens. And one thing I wanted to respond to Representative Greenlick from last time was the situation of prioritization for retirees. And maybe in one of the letters that you have received from our organization was a recollection of what happened in 1994, shortly after the Oregon Health Plan was passed. There was a six-year-old child in Medford who had leukemia and needed a bone marrow transplant. But under the listing of priorities, and this was publicly discussed in town hall meetings, that procedure fell below the line. So I feel that that prioritization list should apply to everyone, not just people under the Medicaid program. I worry that if we ignore the Medicare role and overall cost of health care, we will be doing little to address the real problems in health care delivery and financing. Medicare has a ripple effect that goes throughout all other systems of healthcare delivery. The AARP last week statement said that Medicare is a federal problem and should be fixed by federal action. I just talked with the representative this evening. I said, why doesn't AARP take Senate Bill 27 and use it as their standard to change Medicare? The nation deserves to hear the good ideas coming from Oregonians on how to salvage Medicare and the entire health system. If we don't speak out, there will be bills of far less effectiveness, which already have been introduced, including H.R. 676. You may have this in front of you that was written by Chin Lee, M.D., from Corvallis, who outlines if Senate Bill 27 is not considered, he wants these key elements, or we want these key elements included, including changing the name of Accountable Health Plan to Health Care Organizations. So it's clearer that an organization like the Corvallis Clinic could interact directly as an accountable health care system. Another part of that, in the second paragraph, number A, that health accountable health care plans operate under the same capitation rate. Maybe that's in part of the 329-4, I'm not sure. And then to answer the problem about pre-existing illness, can we simply change the wording to say there must be explicit proof of residence of 1 year or more before coverage can be offered? So I and members of PASSION from Corvallis urge you to give Senate Bill 27 a fair hearing. If that's not possible, I personally favor going to a ballot initiative that will expand the statewide debate and opportunity for public input. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony tonight, Mike. Appreciate you coming back up here again.
Oh, there's one other thing that you may have in front of you. This is from Chin Lee in Corvallis, and it may help you talk with your colleagues about what is socialized medicine and what isn't. And so it divides the types of financing and healthcare delivery systems into four categories, and most of them you can see are in the lower left-hand corner, in which it is state financing but private delivery. So that may ease some of the concerns of your colleagues, if that's possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ellen Penny.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ellen Penny. I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I want to thank you for all the work you've done on this, and I appreciate seeing some of the amendments that we offered in your Dash 4 amendments to 329. I did send in a list of other amendments, and I'd like to review some of those, but first I'd like to say that one of our concerns that I'm not sure is being addressed by the amendments is the status of employer-sponsored health plans. The ability to capture the money that employers who now pay for health care are currently contributing to the system, and the ability or the effort or the need to make sure that in a system which asks both individuals and employers to pay something, we get employers on the same playing field. And we asked some questions in the amendments we offered, but we would like you to clarify as you proceed with this plan. Which is, will access to an accountable health plan continue to be an employment-based benefit for those whose employers choose to offer the benefits in an accountable health plan? Will employees be able to keep their selected accountable health plan as they move through different jobs, as they change income, and as they get older? Will the answer to this question be true even if the employer makes a different accountable health plan available? In other words, is there a way that you can envision for employees to be able to keep their plan through employers even if the employer makes an accountable health plan available? And if an employer is offering an accountable health plan to their workforce and is requiring that employees contribute to that, is there some ability for the employee to hold on to their own accountable health plan without having to contribute again? Those are all questions I think that need to be answered as you consider how you get to a place where I think all of us would hope that we can get to, which is that instead of having health care and your ability to have a health plan contingent on your employment, you have a health plan because you live in Oregon, you're a resident in Oregon, and that health plan goes with you no matter where you go. I want to just speak briefly to the Dash 4 amendments. I'm surprised that you would remove the authority of the fund to seek other federal matching funds as if there are no other federal matching funds to be sought other than Medicaid. I think it would be... It's sad to not allow them to consider other federal matching funds, given that they would have to come back to the legislature to get approval to seek any others. And I'm not sure what others are out there, but clearly the Archimedes movement has spoken to at least two. Along the same lines, I'm a little disappointed to see that you eliminate from the Dash 4 amendments the ability to reevaluate the contracts of existing prepaid managed care health service organizations that are currently in place. In a broader and long-term vision of universal coverage, it seems you would need to retain the ability to look at contracts that are now being signed with prepaid managed health care plans. I'm not able to understand from the description of the Dash 4 that you gave how you deal with what we would consider the essential accountability of an accountable health plan. And in our recommendations for amendments, we suggested that a subcommittee be formed to look at the definition of an accountable health plan, including the role of pre-existing condition exclusions, particularly in the context of a program that requires some kind of waiting period for enrollment. We would suggest that would be a consideration that should be made by this committee or this work group that we would envision having a conversation about accountable health plan. standards for timeliness of access and geographic distribution of access points within the accountable health plans, loss ratio limitations, the rating structures, profit or nonprofit status, the uniformity of provider reimbursement structures. All of those, it would seem, would be appropriate for a task force or committee to be looking at under the banner of what is an accountable health plan and how do we make sure that they're accountable. And those would be my comments. I really appreciate the work you've done and the time that you've given us to provide testimony.
Questions?
A couple quick comments. I'm sorry. Is there a question on there?
So just going to be a comment about one of the things that I brought up that actually is relating to portability, and that is that with the implementing of a health insurance exchange, which is one of the instructions that the Oregon Health Trust Board would receive, that exchange could be set up in a way that employers could utilize the policies through the exchange. And so we said if it's set up right, the exchange would qualify for the deduction, and then but the policy itself belongs to the employee, and then if the employee leaves that employment, they can either pay for it themselves or go to another employee who may be with the exchange, and so they can maintain the continuity of coverage by the way that the exchange should be organized.
I'm very thankful that Representative Richardson is here to explain that, because that's exactly where we're trying to go. Thank you, Dennis.
Mr. Chair,
there is portability involved in this and through the exchange, and that's one of the key issues of this, is that it's portable and follows the employee, okay? Senator Greenlink. Representative Greenlink.
You keep wanting to moat me here.
Sorry.
I really would like to raise the same point Ellen raised in the Section 11-1AD, removing authority to seek other federal matching funds. I'm not sure where that came from, and I could imagine, I mean, I could just make some up. For example, TRICARE might turn out to be some federal matching that we might want to be involved in a variety of ways. There might be others. So I wonder why we want to eliminate that.
That was part of the design to deal with the Medicare issue, and we will revisit that. Okay, and the language may not be crafted well enough. We're not trying to exclude everything, but that was the decision made, was to try to remove Medicare from the issue here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we will revisit that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, can I say one other piece about that? In our proposed amendments, we actually suggested that there be a work group established to look at Medicare. We think keeping Medicare completely off the table in consideration of how providers are compensated in any kind of ability to get to a much more intelligent reimbursement system, which we would call an all-payer reimbursement system, where instead of having providers who serve Medicaid clients get paid a different rate from providers who accept employed clients, from providers who accept other clients, we're paying all providers the same for the same services. We cannot do that without considering Medicare in this mix. And rather than be prescriptive about what we should do with Medicare funds, I think it's appropriate, given the seeming intent of this committee to not continue considerations around SB 27, to at least add a clause in the work groups or some function within this bill that would allow ongoing and deliberate consideration of the role Medicare and any kind of changes in Medicare would play in a universal system in Oregon.
Thank you, Ellen. Let me offer two pieces to you that might be helpful on some of the other issues. You had prepaid managed care plans, the FCHIPs. What we didn't want to have happen in this bill is inadvertently on, January 1st, 2008, all those contracts to end. Those contracts looked at and reviewed and negotiated on a regular basis. We want that process to continue. We didn't want to interrupt that process inadvertently with this bill. So that's referring to.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and would think that that would be very wise, that it may not go away on January 1st, 2008, but sometime in the future, there may want to be a consideration of how you realign those contracts or whether those contracts as they exist now even have a place in the system that we're envisioning, where a plan goes with somebody through their eligibility for Medicaid into employment and beyond.
I hear your discussion. My discussion back is that we have something here in Oregon that's uniquely Oregon, and our F-chips are something that we're going to build. It's a building block for our state, and we do not want to lose those plans, jeopardize them. That's what that language is all about, so I'm just being real front with you. Everything is in accountable health plans. We debated how deeply to go in, frankly, the OHAC language. How deeply, how much detail do we want to put into this, and elected not to go too deep a level. We don't want to be tying the hands of this design team, this interim board. We think they're going to go there anyway. And accountable health plans are more than just that. We're talking about plans that now start looking at outcomes for the people they're dealing with, for their patients, not just, you know, what we've seen as the routine and what we've dealt with for the last 30 years. Insurance companies have indicated to us they are ready to take on that challenge of looking at what's the outcomes of the program we're offering to our patients, which is really an important change. So accountability isn't just where's the money going, what's your loss ratio. It's more than that. It's about really producing health. And the plans we've talked to are ready to go there, and we appreciate their cooperation in that. But we don't want to tie the hands of this board real tightly. I expect they'll go right with those issues you've got there, but they'll probably go farther than that, too. Okay?
I would hope so, Senator Bates.
I hope that reassures
thank you very
you
much.
So. Any other questions? Thank you, Alan. Oops, I'm sorry. Senator Morrison.
Thank you,
Morris.
Mr. Chair. I appreciate your comments with respect to Medicare. It seems to me that the charge to this board would be incomplete if we didn't address the elephant in the room, at least conceptually, how it would fit into something in the future. If Medicare is included in this, is it a poison pill? I can't see that it is, because this work by this board is to be presented back for legislative approval before it's implemented. And it would seem to me that some clause that references Medicare and how it would integrate into the system of care that we would, you know, emerge here would be a worthy discussion point.
Well, Senator Morris, if it doesn't have a constitutional problem, I would consider that.
You're suggesting that in any way that we address Medicare, that it would be unconstitutional?
No, I'm not saying it's unconstitutional. I'm talking about a number like 16 and 31. That kind of a constitutional problem.
Oh, you're talking about within the body?
Yes, I am, sir.
So the reference to a poison pill is your concern?
Yes. That can be explored. I'd be glad to explore that with you.
I think it would be worth testing.
Absolutely. We have a conversation yet. This is not the final version yet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, can I just say that the amendment that we offered on Medicare is pretty innocuous. It just suggests that there needs to be a look at it. And we have my current employer, when he turned 65, got a letter from his doctor saying, I will no longer be your doctor because you are now accepting Medicare. And that seems, in the context of a smart, portable health plan, to be unacceptable. So without looking at that kind of wall that happens when you turn 65, I think we miss an opportunity. And I would hope that there are ways of structuring reference to considering Medicare that would not jeopardize the success of this bill, because I think that's important. And in that same vein, I would suggest that if we're going to a portable healthcare system to allow FCHIPs in Oregon to remain intact with their current contract in language that permanently prohibits reconsideration of those contracts in the context of this bill, I think is somewhat problematic. So I would just submit that, and I thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Alicia Juber.
Chair Senator Bates and honorary members of this committee. My name is Alicia Juber, and many members of this committee have heard me testify before other committees on a different matter, the one that also pertains to health care in Oregon. As to Bill 329, I wish to add my voice to the chorus for this type of comprehensive board to help assure health care coverage is there for all citizens of Oregon, no matter economic status. This truly is a crisis in our state. I do hope there is continued discussion about a salary cap and term limits, as state boards can sometimes hurt more than they help. That's a strong and maybe offensive statement, and I apologize for this, but I've had experience with one, and I feel very strongly because of it. At last Monday's hearing, I heard Senator Mona Sanderson address one area of the bill pertaining to drug, alcohol, and mental health issues, though forgive me, I don't remember the exact context. It's an area which I have a great deal of personal experience being in recovery myself. I feel I actually am in recovery from psych units and drug and alcohol treatment centers, and the seemingly little understanding each has for the other in relationship to the patients they treat. I say this with a slight tongue-in-cheek emphasis, but there's a deeper reality that nearly cost me my sanity and life at one not too distant time. And it was around drug diagnosis, a term I feel is misstated by some treatment centers, which makes the cost higher for the patient, and I don't mean just in money. I entered the system in 1974 with my first mental health unit stay for a suicide attempt from the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. No drugs or alcohol were involved. But a few years later, after that event, I began to see alcohol as the only medication I could trust while I would have moments of confusion that ended me in psych units. But as many know, the tolerance for alcohol can go up, and though much later called a high-functioning alcoholic, I would stop that drug when the confusion ended, and I would then go on with life until certain stress started the cycle all over again. In 1986, while in a Portland hospital psych unit, I heard for the first time the words, "You might be an alcoholic." But the fact that I had now documented mental health conditions, that was always the number one priority, because it took on a very destructive manifestation, 5-point restraint, secure, and legal drugs seemed to be the staff's only answer to keep me from offing myself, ridding society of one more parasite as I thought of myself. At times in this history, I've been dependent on the graces of taxpayer dollars, many my own, but still felt ashamed. I definitely disliked the waste I saw around me of funds by the very agencies there to help, when I had worked hard for renewed health to become productive again. Jackson County Mental Health, this is added, and I can give you the statement if you want this one in there. Jackson County Mental Health Program and Vocational Rehabilitation were instrumental through the programs they offered me. Some were stopped with the budget cuts. My heart broke for those left alone in their battles after that. I now share this history, giving thanks for the recovery from the worst of some well-meaning mental health professionals and addiction center staff. I now know what can be accomplished if one's spirit isn't completely buried in the dark, frightening corners of a hospital.
It's okay. Take a breath. We're all here.
It is the accumulation of all experience throughout the healthcare system still in place for many people with these diseases. Now, that now gives me the courage to be in the light of the halls of Oregon's Capitol building, speaking with senators and representatives about protection of our state's vulnerable citizens. Though I will have to deal with these health issues the rest of my life no longer is ruled by them. The proper medication helps. There are many of us who enter the system asking for help but leave far worse off after our time spent there, with money seemingly wasted. And to add insult to injury, the staff of most treatment centers tell residents, and I quote, "Only 2% of you will make it. Which two of you sitting here will it be?" Excuse me, but that doesn't say much for drug and alcohol treatment, and I'm sick of hearing those stats exist, because drunks and drug users, on the whole, don't want treatment to get well. Maybe it's because there are other serious mental problems not being addressed, which hold the key to complete recovery for the whole person, their first or second time through. But after numerous times in treatment, a loud bell should be ringing in someone's ear other than the ka-chink of the cash register. I do not profess to know a lot about the complexities of Bill 329, and this testimony might be out of place, but I do know the professionals who will run health fund board need to be fully aware of some of the pitfalls as seen to the eyes of those who have experienced the reality of being inside the many systems. Otherwise, funds will continue to be wasted, not benefiting the systems it's meant for, or the citizens it's meant for in the first place. The funds picked up from the feds, public, employees, and individual and employer contributions need to be spent right, plastic card or not. And the word accountable is not one to be used lightly anymore by anyone. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
You should thank you for stepping up. It's always hard to share personal experiences in public, but it's important. And, you know, one of the goals of this plan is to integrate mental and alcohol and drug and physical health for the first time, and that comorbidities do exist and all need to be treated. So I appreciate your testimony. Thank you for having the courage stepping up here. Congratulations on your recovery.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
Mr. Huber, thank you so very much for your testimony. And the intent of Senate Bill 329 overall is, of course, we want an efficient medical process system, but truly we want to have quality care. And you have experienced not good quality care in many cases, and that's what we need to look at. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sanderson. Chair.
Thank you. I'm somewhat reluctant to call the next two up here, but I'm going to do it anyway. These two women scare me, Sydney Becker and Jan Buffa. Thank you, ladies. Please identify yourself and keep the microphones closed because it doesn't pick up well otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which is an association of 11 of the 14 Medicaid managed care plans. We serve over 260,000 OHP clients around the state. First and foremost, I'd like to applaud your efforts and tell you that COHO strongly supports Senate Bill 329. We do ask for the inclusion of two amendments, and I see that the 329-4 does address one of them. But the other one is that we would like to see in the definition of accountable health plan explicit inclusion of the FCHIP statute, because the fully capitated health plans are not licensed through the Department of Consumer and Business Service, which is currently the definition of the accountable health plans in the 700 series. So we would appreciate it if you would add a statement in the definition of accountable health plan that also said, to provide a health benefit plan as defined in ORS 743.730 or ORS 741.725, fully capitated health plans. As you know, Oregon's system of providing managed care to Oregon health plan clients has evolved into one in which we all can be proud. Increased access, financial predictability, low administrative overhead, and quality outcomes continue to be areas of focus for all the plans. We do applaud your efforts, and we're very happy to see the principles and goals outlined in sections 3 and 4. We are also very pleased to see the focus on primary care and want to make sure that it extends to continuing and coordinating the delivery of health care across the existing silos, because this really is about delivering health services differently. Right now, the silos are mental health, addictions, physical health, dental care, long-term care, and any given individual may need two or three or all of those services, yet they have to figure out how to navigate between all of those services, and it's difficult for those of us in the best of health and the best of state of mind. It's even more difficult for individuals who have these service needs. So we really hope that this new health care reform bill leads to innovation around the way we deliver services so that, in fact, we can have an integrated, seamless system of care for all Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Maybe Jan, you're going to cover this other part, so I'll let you have your testimony first because I've got a question for you, or at least an answer to one of your questions.
Do you want me to move forward then?
Please move forward, Jan.
Chair Bates, Chair Westland, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Pardon me?
For the record, can you identify yourself?
Yes. For the record, my name is Jan Buffa, and I'm here representing the 500 physicians practicing in Marion and Polk counties, members of the Mid-Valley Independent Physicians Association, a not-for-profit taxable mutual benefit company headquartered in Salem, Oregon. We want to applaud your efforts, your optimism, and the passion you've shown in the endeavor to address the unmet health care needs of 600,000 uninsured Oregon citizens, and for acknowledging the fact that the health care cost trend is not sustainable for many of our state employers. Mid-Valley, through its subsidiaries, the Marion Polk Community Health Plan, an Oregon Health Plan contractor, and the Marion Polk Community Health Plan Advantage, a Medicare special needs plan, provides health care and a continuum of services to over 38,000 of the citizens of Marion and Polk County. In addition, the physicians have chosen to form a mutual employers trust, and we are currently self-insuring our physicians, their office staff, and family members. In addition to that, Mid-Valley contracts with a multitude of the state's commercial insurers, and at this point in time, we are helping them provide access and medical management to over 79,000 commercial members. MVPA participates as a community-based fully capitated health plan, one of the many mentioned by Cindy Becker. Cindy provided a comprehensive overview of the services provided by the prepaid managed care plan, so I do not want to be duplicitous in my testimony. You've got copies of that also. We do support the amendments that the Coalition for Healthy Oregonians as provided by Ms. Becker has turned in, and we do see that the majority of those were included in the dash fours, and we greatly appreciate that. What I would like to discuss with you are the essential features of SB 329, and I pulled those from the summary on the bill. We do support the creation of the Oregon Health Trust Board, charged with creating the blueprint for reform that delivers health and health care when needed to all members of our state. We support the board's focus on primary and preventative care when establishing an affordable benefits package. We support choice of health care provider insurer from a list of accountable health plans as you determine they be defined. We support the streamlining of health care functions across state agencies to the degree that it's feasible and makes sense and adds value in terms of partnership with the private market in an effort to create efficiencies and reductions in administrative costs. I think that the committee would be well served, and I'm sure you have and anticipate doing further work on this, but to take a thoughtful assessment of what the current Oregon Health Plan contractors and commercial carriers are currently providing, whether it be Kaiser Permanente, Providence, Regents, or any number of the fully based capitated health plans mentioned by my esteemed colleague. State of Oregon chose prepaid managed care as the model for the basis of the Oregon Health Plan. CMS, through its Medicare Advantage Plan, has chosen prepaid capitated model. This model has served the state of Oregon well during its most prosperous times when we were able to cover a larger percentage of our population, and it served us well, albeit with fewer persons covered in the most difficult of economic times. But clearly it was a reimbursement model and a care model and a delivery design that has stood the test of time. Well, we support the board's adoption of rules establishing quality and access standards applicable to a defined set of essential services as covered by the plans. Again, I would encourage the committee during its work session to further examine carefully and weigh thoughtfully the quality and access standards in place at this time to determine best standards and practices. There are many quality and access standards in place employed by both commercial and capitated health plans and our special needs Medicare plans that I feel will merit the committee's attention. and will prove beneficial if they are implemented in any new proposal. We support the establishment of the Oregon Health Fund to appropriate monies to obtain coverage for defined essential list of services and to pay administrative costs. I will just urge the committee members to carefully consider the benefit package as provided by FEOP, Oregon Health Plan, and the Medicare Special Needs Plans in the development of this defined set of services. In addition, I did make some notation in my written testimony as to the current administrative costs for Oregon Health Plan. Those are paid at 8%. Many of the Medicare Special Needs Plans are functioning near 12% in terms of total administrative costs, whereas some of the commercial administrative expense is reported to be between 11 and 25, and I do appreciate and respect the fact that that varies across those commercial plans. We support the creation of an interim task force to develop strategies for streamlining state agencies and programs, and again, I would just ask committee members to look at the wealth of programs already in place in your own communities at this time that are serving Oregonians. In summary, I do remain optimistic about our abilities and your efforts to create a sustainable healthcare system, one that promotes health and wellness, provides a primary care home to all Oregon citizens, access to appropriate levels of care, one that optimizes the state resources and builds upon the many innovation and innovative programs that are in place across the state at this time. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rates that you reference, Jan, for administrative costs.
Yes, sir.
On the one hand, most of those Oregon Health Plan costs, I assume, are capitated plans.
Yes.
And the commercial administrative expense would likely be dominated by fee-for-service.
Yes, sir.
It raises a very interesting point with respect to costs and the direction that we're thinking that this logically could go in terms of emphasizing capitated plans and its impact on the total cost of health care.
I think it's a good point, and my sense is that the interim design team will be looking at that sort of information very carefully. I understand there's a wide variation in commercial plans. Some of them are at 10 or 11%, some of them aren't. Lots of issues involved there. But it's what that design team has to look at. And I'm looking forward to having that discussion. Okay? Senator Morissette.
Thank you. We're getting down to the nitty-gritty. Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Thank you both for the support and your thoughts. Please feel free to offer more thoughts as you go along, which I'm sure you'll be able to do. And I have a letter here from Mr. Steve Howard of the Mid-Valley IPA. I'll address these, and I mean, it's just basic questions, and I'll get back to you. I'm not going to take committee time tonight if it's okay with you.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. To bring us home, Mr. J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Bates and Westland, and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson representing NFIB Oregon. I've got a business association of about 12,000 employers, independently owned businesses here in Oregon. We agree with Senate Bill 329 and where it purports to go. Just by way of reference, and I don't know if I've mentioned in this committee, but the most outstanding small business concern among our memberships for probably the past 10 years has been the cost of health care, cost of health insurance. And it's gotten to the point where there's really not even a close second place. And we had an occasion to gather member input and data from around the state, doing two cycles, actually, just prior to session, which confirmed our belief and my belief that small business is willing to have the large-scale discussion as embodied in 329. But I don't think we've been there before. I think we're at a sort of a crucible moment where we're willing to talk about big steps different ways to finance and deliver health care that, quite frankly, I don't think small employers were 5 to 10 years ago. And I think we see that sea change, and that's evident in our organization. Having said that, and given our support for 329, you should know that it is also probably your most skeptical constituency with where you're going right now, because you're in essence asking them to fund something that they can't quite identify, and although the present system doesn't serve them completely well, it is something they know and are familiar with, as opposed to something that we're just asking them to say that you're from the government and here to help. So the from the employer point of view, as it pertains to Senate Bill 329, the thing that stands out to me is as a document, it really doesn't speak to business, and I'd like to at least draw your attention to that so you'd be sensitive to it. But you have an opportunity to speak to our employers through this bill, and I can see, because I don't really have any of my colleagues in the room tonight, why there might not be that influence on the bill. But I would ask you to take the opportunity to speak to employers in this bill. And just by way of example, the preamble, you know, all the whereas comments, you know, we need to talk about what health care costs are doing to private companies today in terms of cutting into earnings and cutting into investments in hiring people and equipment, and making choices about what levels of health care to purchase, and invariably it's less and less with every year. And I think drawing some attention to that is helpful. Section 3 and 4, I think, misses the opportunity to tell employers that they can expect a better product for what they pay for today, or a comparable product for less cost. And I think you should take the opportunity to tell them that the cost will be manageable, and the cost increases they can expect are far less than what they see today. And you should take the opportunity to tell them that there's choice. If they want to keep on with the present system of purchasing for their employees, that's fine. If they want to contribute to the fund, that's also fine. But it helps allay a concern that small employers have, which is primarily that this is a single-payer system. They can't identify it, but anything they can't identify tends to be, well, this is a single-payer, and they tend to have a knee-jerk reaction as opposed to that. And so I want to avoid those things, because I see that that's not where we intend to go, but I think that should be carefully outlined in this bill. So that's my only comment. I really think the bill is a tool that should be used to talk to employers, and currently it's not being used as such, and I would ask for your sensitivity in that regard.
JL, thank you for testimony. I'm just going to say a couple things to get them on the record in response to your concerns, which are real. As my good coach here often says, it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't know. And I understand that feeling, and I certainly share it with them. We're trying to put this board together in a way, and the language you'll see in the dash four says that the preponderance of members of the board cannot be people who have gain from the system. It can't be providers. The preponderance can't be providers. That means, basically, it's the people who pay for this and consumers. We want those people driving this, so that the business community, for the first time, has an opportunity to be in the driver's seat on what a system looks like, which is really a pretty radical change, and one that we've worked hard to bring about. As far as we're concerned, what the language is trying to say, and we may have to focus it more, is that employers will have an opportunity to stay right where they're at if they're not cost-shifting. If they're self-insured, they stay there if they want to. If they're buying insurance through channels which work for them, that's great. We want to offer them more choices. We want to offer them an exchange, which hopefully will bring those prices down to something that small ones can afford, maybe even with a supplement from the fund for that exchange. We want to see the FIAT program enlarged so that small employers can take advantage of it and know it's going to be there next year, not just something they get started with this year and it's not there the next year. So we need those things to happen. We want to make this something better. And if we can't control costs and bring costs down, we really haven't done a thing here. We just rearranged the deck on the chair, or the chairs on the deck, I should say. So I appreciate your comments, and I'd ask you to look at the dashboards, and if we're not getting to where you think we need to be getting to, you please let us know.
Sure.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, JL.
Thank you very much for your support. We had tried to get through by 6:30 tonight. We're doggone close, folks. You may not be so lucky Wednesday night, but please try to digest the dash fours, and we expect a robust discussion on Wednesday. We look forward to seeing you again, and we are adjourned.
Mr. Chair?
Whoops. Yes.
For those out there in audio streaming land, the dash fours are up on hopeforahealthyoregon.com.
Already? Okay.
So you can see those online.
Mr. Co-Chair, didn't know that. That's quick. Thank you very much for your attention this evening. We are adjourned.